Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
First, released hostage Peter Theo Curtis spoke briefly to the media gathered outside his mother's Cambridge, Massachusetts home today after arriving back in the U.S. last night. The government of Qatar helped negotiate the release of the 45-year-old writer from an al-Qaeda-related group in Syria. Others, like a retired American media mogul and a former FBI agent, were also involved, and Curtis expressed thanks.
In the days following my release on Sunday, I have learned bit by bit that there have been literally hundreds of people, brave, determined, and big-hearted people all over the world working for my release. They've been working for 2 years on this. I had no idea when I was in prison. I had no idea that so much effort was being expended on my behalf. And now, having found out, I am just overwhelmed with emotion.
His comments were very brief. He told the waiting journalists he understood their need for interviews and he'd one day do them, but said he wanted to bond now with his mother. Clint Van Zandt of the threat assessment group Van Zandt Associates and also a former chief negotiator for the FBI who's done lots of work overseas in hostage situations joins us now. And Clint, we just want to get a sense of what may be going on here. Were you surprised that the comments were so brief?
No, Robin, I really wasn't. I'm sure that there was advice given to both Theo as well as his mother to keep the comments brief right now. Realize that this man is just being introduced back into what he knows to be the real world. I mean, the idea of turning a faucet on or flushing a toilet or going to a refrigerator may be something that he's been deprived of for almost 2 years. So I think they're going to want to bring him back, help him come back slowly to understand what he's been through and what his future holds.
Well, there's that. But then you wonder if he's also being advised not to say things that might endanger other hostages. And let's remind ourselves, Theo Curtis is fascinating. He was a writer, is a writer, a scholar. He wrote about disaffected Muslims in Yemen in his book Undercover Muslim, in which he went undercover, posing as a convert to try to find out what would make someone convert. He wrote about how he'd met one convert in Yemen, Curtis Bledsoe, who then went on to shoot at a military recruiting office in Arkansas in 2009, killing one soldier. So he was conducting very risky business in his writing, but he also could have information for officials?
Well, of course he does, Robin. Part of this is going to be getting that information to officials. And in a case like this or any case, it's always a two-track type of investigation, like a set of railroad tracks. Track number one is conducting negotiations through official and many times unofficial channels, trying to broker some type of a release. And as you know, the U.S. government is not going to pay a ransom, but other private individuals and companies do. The second part, the second track, is coming up with tactical information that could aid, that could assist if a decision is made to do a hostage rescue mission like was done on July 4th. And unfortunately, when we went in to get the most recent hostage who was murdered, he had already been moved. But the government is always going to move like that. And again, this al-Qaeda branch that was holding Theo also is believed to hold at least two other Americans, and I'm sure a number of other Europeans and international. So you want to be very careful what's said. We don't want to anger them needlessly and have them take some untoward action against one of the hostages they continue to hold.
Well, you bring up something interesting. There are companies like yours and others. We read about Krill, which is another company. People literally advising families whose loved ones have been taken hostage. People most Americans didn't even know about. And suddenly this has burbled up in a horrible way. You mentioned James Foley and the failed attempt to rescue him, and in a jubilant way with the release of Theo Curtis. But what should people do? This morning, the mother of another hostage, Stephen Sotloff, made an emotional plea for his release. She directed her appeal to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS. Here she addresses him as Caliph, his self-declared title as leader of the Muslim community.
I've always learned that you, the Caliph, can grant amnesty. I ask you to please release my child. As a mother, I ask your justice to be merciful and not punish my son for matters he has no control over.
Any sense, this was on the Arabia Network, but any sense, Clint, is this the right thing to do? How do you know?
We want to be careful not to pay ransom, nor do we want to pay hostage to a group, nor do we want to upset them. The government, the FBI, will advise family members, help them construct statements like this. But again, the more attention we give groups like this, unfortunately, the more kidnappings we're likely to see.
Well, hopefully her words will have some effect either way. Clint Van Zandt, a former chief negotiator for the FBI in hostage situations. His group is Van Zandt Associates. Clint, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Now to politics. Florida's Republican Governor Rick Scott and former Florida Governor Charlie Crist, a Republican turned Democrat, easily won their primary elections yesterday. That paves the way for what's expected to be a nasty, expensive fight to November. But now we turn to a very different race for this week's district profile. Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District has a Republican state senator and a Democratic county executive vying to fill the seat being vacated by retiring Republican Congressman Tom Petri. There's not a lot of outside money in this race. In fact, the Democrat hardly has enough money to make a TV ad. Annalise Hensel of Here and Now contributing station WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio is with us to share details. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Sasha.
And would you describe this district to us in terms of some of the demographics and geography and politics?
Sure. Beginning with the demographics and the politics, this is a heavily Republican district. The House seat that is up for election this year has been in Democrats' hands only two out of the last 75 years. So I think that gives you a pretty clear sense politically.
Sure.
Geographically, it is north of Milwaukee, if you can picture that, and south of Green Bay. It borders Lake Michigan to the east, and it stretches to about central Wisconsin on the west, hitting Wisconsin Dells, which is a resort town that calls itself the water park capital of the world. The district also includes Ripon, which is known as the birthplace of the Republican Party.
Now, this retiring congressman, Tom Petri, he's been in office since 1979. He's considered moderate, and he was willing to work with Democrats on a number of measures over the years. Let's look at the two candidates in the race to replace him, starting with the candidate from his own party, Republican Glenn Grothman. Here is Grothman in one of his ads.
It's hard to tell politicians in Washington apart. Too many in both parties are caving in to Obama and exploding our debt. But not Glenn Grothman. Glenn has a proven conservative record of fighting liberals, cutting taxes, making it illegal to buy junk food with food stamps, creating jobs, and he won't compromise our values. Not now, not ever.
Annalise, what else should we know about State Senator Grothman?
Well, he's an interesting candidate, especially in contrast to Congressman Petri. Grothman has been in the legislature for about 20 years, and he's pretty well known for legislation that he's promoted, as well as for his outspoken nature. He's never been afraid to speak what's on his mind, and you could probably say that political correctness is not a term that is even in his vocabulary. This was a Republican primary earlier this month with three candidates that were pretty similar when it comes to policies, but they all were trying to describe themselves as being those that would push the party the furthest to the right. And Grothman was the most successful at getting that message out, but he also really presented himself as being the fighter who would not be afraid to take controversial stances. And I'll give you an example. He's claimed in the past that it's okay for women to get paid less on average than men, because many women would prefer to let the man in the family be the breadwinner. Also, Senator Grothman has accused the Obama administration of wanting to march toward an atheistic socialist state. That was a comment that he made at a pro-gun rally in the wake of the Sandy Hook school shooting tragedy. So he's pretty bombastic, and he's using that as part of a way to sell himself.
The Democratic candidate is a local county executive, Mark Harris. He's been campaigning on a platform of fiscal responsibility and raising the minimum wage. And immigration recently came up in an interview he did with the cable access show Eye on Oshkosh out of Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Here's part of Harris's response.
In this part of the country, most crops are picked by immigrant labor.
Mm-hmm.
These large dairies use a lot of Hispanic workers. And there's been attempts to crack down on that,
mm-hmm.
and it often has meant that food products don't get properly harvested. It's not in our interest if there's not a domestic population that's willing and able to do that work.
And Annalise, although he's not saying it totally explicitly in that cut, it sounds like his argument is not to crack down on immigrants crossing over into the U.S. because we need that workforce.
I would agree with that.
What else should we know about Mark Harris?
Well, he describes himself as a fiscally conservative progressive and says that he would be unlikely to join the two Wisconsin House members that are considered part of the progressive caucus. He says he's more moderate and less progressive. He also says that he is the logical successor to outgoing Congressman Tom Petri, who, as we mentioned, is a Republican. Harris says that he is willing to work across the aisle. And as far as his personality and his style goes, he could not be more different from Senator Grothman than he is. Harris is much more soft-spoken, and he takes time to pause before answering questions. And he does appear, just from watching him in interviews, that he would indeed be someone who's much more willing to reach out to Republicans in the House.
What's the general sense of how this race is going to go?
Well, Glenn Grothman is the person to put the money on if you were to make a bet. He has raised about five times as much money as County Executive Harris. He's better known across the state because of his years in the legislature, and he's been in the primary contest, which means he's had a lot of ads around the state as well. But analysts say that if a few factors come together, there is a chance that Harris could pull off a win. First, they say some national money would have to come in and provide him a big boost in funding. They also say that Senator Grothman would have to do something to upset voters, including perhaps putting his foot in his mouth as he says something that's controversial or maybe unpopular. And the third factor is if Democrats and independents in Wisconsin are very, very motivated in that 6th congressional district to go to the polls in the gubernatorial race and to vote for the Democrat, that could put Harris over the top in that district. And the gubernatorial race in Wisconsin is the most important one on the ticket this fall. It involves first-term Republican Governor Scott Walker and a Democrat named Mary Burke, who's a former Commerce Secretary and business executive. And because that's so hot and the two of them are in a dead heat, there's a chance for Harris that if people come out for Burke, they also would come out for him.
That's Annalise Henzel of Here and Now, contributing station WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Annalise, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
In Philadelphia, two rival newspapers are in the middle of a bitter feud. They share an owner and even a building, but they've come to very different conclusions about a series of stories involving police corruption in the city. In 2009, the city's tabloid, the Philadelphia Daily News, published an investigation about widespread corruption in the police force. That series won a Pulitzer. Then 5 years later, just a few months ago, its sister paper, the Philadelphia Inquirer, began investigating why a police officer at the center of that scandal was never charged. In the process, the Inquirer says it turned up evidence that the Daily News had undermined the investigation and that its reporters had acted unethically. NPR's David Folkenflik is here with us to help us sort this out. Hi, David.
Hey, Sasha.
All right, so let's go back to 2009. What happened in that original investigation by the Daily News?
Well, there were a series of articles in the tabloid Daily News called under the rubric of Tainted Justice, and it really offered evidence of widespread corruption grounded in the narcotics department. There were these accounts that search warrants were routinely faked, of cops going in to sort of search bodegas that they suspected of selling illegal drug paraphernalia, them looting those bodegas, you know, sort of cutting off those closed-circuit TVs and having their way. And there was also a couple of accounts of sexual assaults against women by one particular officer who had the literary name of Thomas Tolstoy. Those articles by the two reporters, Wendy Ruderman and Barbara Laker, were turned into a book published earlier this year. It's supposed to become a TV series involving Sarah Jessica Parker of Sex and the City. And it really helped cement the reputation of those two reporters, giving them a bit of a national foundation and giving the Daily News, the scrappier, smaller paper in Philadelphia, a shining moment as well.
And as I understand it, the Inquirer may not be questioning the basic premise of that story, but it has dug up dirt on its sister paper, the Daily News. So tell us about this curveball.
Well, the curveball came in the form of an article that sought to answer the question as posed in its headline, why is the police officer at the center of this scandal, Thomas Tolstoy, 5 years later, still on the force, still drawing a public paycheck, still carrying a badge and presumably a gun? And the answer that they found was a series of wrinkles, some of which involved the fact that In one case, one accuser who said that she was physically violated, although not explicitly raped, that there was no DNA to sustain her her claim, and that another officer testified that he had been in the presence of this officer when the woman had been confronted by the police officer and said that no such assault had occurred. So there's that. They also said, however, that this woman, who was given the pseudonym Naomi in the Tainted Justice series, that she had changed her story, that she had said that she had actually been offered money for her story by the reporters, that they had offered her certain kinds of help, and that they had dissuaded her from speaking to law enforcement authorities about the assault. So their contention, the police department's contention, the FBI's contention, in a sense, was that they weren't able to get criminal charges lodged against Officer Thomas Tolstoy because of that, that this would interfere with the ability to bring a successful prosecution to resolution. And so you have this situation where the police commissioner, Charles Ramsey in Philadelphia, says that he probably has a police officer on the force who has committed a crime, who's probably guilty of the things that he's been accused of, but that he claims he can't do it because the investigation has been compromised.
All right. So some pretty explosive stuff. Yet there was trouble getting this story into print. Why did the Inquirer hold the story back?
Well, it's held back for a little over a month. You know, both the Inquirer and the Daily News are owned by a very wealthy figure in Philadelphia named Jerry Lenfest. He had been part of a partnership group that had owned the papers, both of them troubled for several years, and then won the right to own them outright at an auction earlier this year with a partner named Lewis Katz. Katz died in a plane crash right around that time.
Right, here in Massachusetts, in fact, exactly.
That's right. And he emerged as the sole owner. And then he's confronted by the fact that his prestigious broadsheet newspaper, the Philadelphia Inquirer, in some ways the newspaper of record for Philly, has developed this story based on what are called 302s. That's the raw notes taken by FBI agents of interviews with witnesses or subjects in investigations that seem to undercut the integrity of reporting done by his other paper, the scrappy tabloid Daily News. And he decided initially to stand by his reporters at the Daily News, Randy Ruderman and Barbara Laker, who emphatically denied and still, you know, even in conversations as of this morning when I spoke with Wendy Ruderman, you know, continue to say, hey, they didn't do what the woman Naomi claims they did. They didn't offer anything inappropriate. They didn't behave unethically. And he decided to stand by them. But, you know, the Columbia Journalism Review and other local press and blogs started to report on the fact that the Inquirer was sitting on a story that could be damaging to its corporate sibling. And suddenly Jerry Lenfest was confronted with a terrible choice. You know, what do you do? Do you protect one paper or do you stifle the journalism of another? Ultimately, he decided to put it in print.
So, David, as you just said, the two Daily News reporters, Wendy Ruderman and Barbara Laker, are denying these allegations. But if the allegations are true, let's do this as a hypothetical and talk about sort of the ethics of this, the journalism ethics. If they did pay and coach the witness, at what length can a reporter go to get a story and still be within ethical bounds?
Well, you know, journalism is not regulated by federal authorities. So in American journalist and traditions and practices, you don't pay people to give interviews. You don't pay people for information. And the reason you don't do that is that there's the concern, I think quite legitimate, that people might shape their stories. They might juice their tale to earn those payments. And perhaps they think a juicier story might get a better payment. And suddenly you've got a system of a market-based approach to getting information. I will say that, you know, in other countries, they do things differently. And certainly, you know, tabloid and gossip sites, the National Enquirer, TMZ come to mind. They probably pay people for information. The real question, if you do something like that, is are you willing to be transparent with your audience so that you understand how you came by that information? And in a way, there's a sleight of hand done often at the network television level where networks will pay people not for the interview but perhaps for photographs or video or for other elements. ABC News was forced to admit in court it had paid over $200,000 to help pay the legal fees of a woman who was a defendant in a celebrated case in Florida for being on trial for having killed her own daughter. And so there are ways in which places get around that, it's seen as not ethical and it's seen as doubly unethical not to disclose that. Now, in talking to Wendy Ruderman, I want to underscore, she says we didn't do that. In the book that the two reporters wrote, they acknowledged giving some minor gifts to one of their sources, but months after the stories had been published so that they were no longer sources. And in this case, they say Naomi, you know, is simply saying things that didn't happen. She'd been a reluctant witness for authorities. She'd been a reluctant subject for their interview. They ultimately coaxed them there. She says this may be just Naomi's effort to get out of the spotlight once again. But, you know, it's a moment where law enforcement officials can say, look, even if the reporters didn't act unethically, the witness is no longer reliable, consistent witness to what she says transpired. In the meantime, the Daily News reporters say, hey, you know, our reputations are being trampled.
That's David Folkenflik. He is NPR's media correspondent. David, thank you.
You bet.
While the Obama administration explores options to combat ISIS in Syria, Kurdish fighters are gaining ground against Sunni militants in neighboring Iraq. The Peshmerga forces have recaptured areas they lost to ISIS earlier this month near Mosul in northern Iraq. The BBC's Jim Muir has been with the Kurdish fighters, and he has this report.
This is the front line of the Peshmerga positions, the Kurdish positions. Saying no American air cover. A week ago, they bombed some ISIS-held villages far, far away behind the current line, so it wasn't linked to this current campaign. The Peshmerga recaptured these positions against ISIS without any air support either from the Americans or from the Iraqi army. Shakir Ismail, one of the Peshmerga Kurdish officers there, explaining the situation. The fact that the Kurdish forces made this significant advance without the help of American airstrikes seems to reflect a growing self-confidence after their own rout by the Islamist onslaught here earlier this month. General Najat Ali Fatah is the Kurdish commander in the area.
I think we could protect our land and our territory, especially this area.
So you are confident that ISIS cannot come back again, cannot return?
Yeah, I'm confident because I know Daesh forces would be very weak against us. They couldn't fight us, and now we're using a lot of tactics against them.
The Kurds say they will still need to ask for U.S. airstrikes in some places, and they also need heavier weaponry, artillery, armor, and much besides. But they seem sure they can do their own fighting on the ground, and that they've broken the wall of fear surrounding ISIS, as Shakir Ismail explained.
ISIS created fear and terror among the people by killing and slaughtering, and putting it in video clips on the social media. It's psychological warfare. But on the ground, ISIS can't resist the Peshmerga. We have broken this fear and we are advancing.
But across the border in northern Syria, a very different picture. Supporters of the Islamic State were loudly celebrating its capture of the airbase at Tabqa, the last government stronghold in Raqqa province, which is at the heart of the self-declared caliphate. A highly produced video put out by the Islamic State showed how such attacks are done. First, a huge suicide bomb explosion. Then a ground offensive. It showed dozens of regime soldiers fleeing and being gunned down. Some were captured. One was later decapitated, his head spiked on a fence in Raqqa city. Faced by all this, Syria's foreign minister Walid al-Mu'allim said Damascus was ready to cooperate against terrorism with all outside powers, including the US and Britain. But he warned against unilateral airstrikes.
Any military action without coordination with the Syrian government, it is aggression. And the Syrian government is obliged to take all possible measures to defend its sovereignty.
The slow advances of the Kurdish forces in northern Iraq show that it can be done. But these are very small beginnings to a massive task that's growing by the day.
That report from the BBC's Jim Muir in northern Iraq.
Journey guitarist Neil Sean says he's open to the idea of reuniting with Steve Perry, the voice behind that band's greatest 1980s hits. Perry's kind of been a recluse since the mid-1990s, but he returned to the stage after two decades joining the Eels in St. Paul, Minnesota, singing one of Journey's greatest hits. Come on, you know it. Everybody does. If you had a cigarette lighter, wouldn't it be aloft? Now, the Eels attract a pretty hip audience, but everyone was up and singing by the end of the set. Maybe they didn't know that early reviews called Journey's music banal, plodding, a dank hole of Drek-Ola. I'm betting that some who did know stood anyway, because according to our next guest, Journey represents the very best of schlock music, and that is a compliment. Jody Rosen is pop music critic for New York Magazine and Vulture.com. His article is titled In Defense of Schlock Music, Why Journey, Billy Joel, and Lionel Richie Are Better Than You Think. It's a celebration of the triumph of schlock music, and Jody joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. Welcome.
Thanks, Robin. Good to be here.
Explain why schlock is good.
My argument is that this music kind of fulfills the role, the sort of most important role that music can fill, which is to appeal baldly and unembarrassedly to the emotions. It's not stuff we deem good taste or what is thought to be, you know, proper art. It's kind of raggedly emotional. And, you know, that's kind of the trump card that music holds over the other arts, I think, is the fact that it's the most visceral and ineffable of the arts. It really just, you know, hits you in the stomach. So this music kind of teleports you past the point where you're self-conscious about what it is that you're supposed to be liking, and you just sing along or hold your lighter aloft.
You have no choice. Hey, let's listen to another one from Journey, Don't Stop Believin'. This one, it had just excoriating reviews, as you kind of sum it up by saying that critics considered Journey just like that moldering food stuff that you dread finding in the back of your refrigerator. Let's listen to Don't Stop Believin'. Hey, Jody, streetlight people living just to find emotion hiding somewhere in the night. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't make any sense, really. I mean, you know, he's very broadly sketching a kind of beautiful loser. Part of what I point out in this piece, or what I like about this sort of music, is the meaninglessness, the doggerel, isn't a problem. The fact that Steve Perry's singing about streetlight people, I don't really know what a streetlight person is.
They're out
there.
It
doesn't matter. I feel like one when I listen to the song.
Well, as you say, schlock at its finest is where bad taste becomes great art. It's music that subjugates all other values to brute emotional impact. Tell us more about the etymology of the word schlock.
Well, schlock comes from a Yiddish word, schlack, which I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong, and my bubby of blessed memory would kill me if she heard this. But in any case, it's a word which refers to kind of cheap secondhand goods. Actually, a secondary meaning, this is something I didn't know coming in, but a secondary meaning of the word schlock in Yiddish is epileptic fit or something along those lines, which also makes a little sense if you've seen some of these performances, if you've seen, you know, Steve Perry on stage or
well, there's some people
on stage. But one of the points that I want to emphasize in the piece is that this is, I'm not just referring, for instance, to 80s power ballads, although I 100% embrace 80s power ballads. Schlock is a kind of musical gesture, I guess you'd say. It's a genre, it's a type of music that thrives in many, many across the board in all sorts of idioms, and its history is quite deep. In fact, the history of schlock really is the history of American popular music.
Give us some examples of that, because you do, you know, on the list, you know, number one is Judy Garland, Over the Rainbow. You take it all the way back to any kind of Americana songs that sing about some, maybe an illusion of a more perfect former place.
For instance, if you look at sentimental Irish ballads that Irish immigrants brought over here in the mid-19th century.
Danny Boy.
Danny Boy. Danny Boy's an example.
Oh, Danny Boy. The pipes are
And then, of course, there's the tradition of blackface minstrelsy. There's a lot of really, I mean, a very problematic tradition, but there were all these great psalms, for instance, the ones written by Stephen Foster, which are putatively written, you know, in the voice of African-American protagonists longing for the old plantation. Now, these again, this is problematic stuff, but this music is at the kind of bedrock of American popular psalm traditions.
I was playing with my brother.
An African-American Paul Robeson singing Old Folks at Home, another Stephen Foster tune, the Holy Grail of Dixieland nostalgia schlock. You have Al Jolson's My Mammy, blackface minstrelsy, Jewish schmaltz. They all collide in Al Jolson's endlessly weird, boundlessly schlocky signature number.
Mammy, mammy, the sun shines east, the sun shines west, I know where the sun shines best.
And I can see people reading this list and starting it off and thinking, yeah, I sort of agree with you. Journey's there at number three. You got Lionel Richie, Endless Love, Bee Gees, How Deep Is Your Love. But wait a minute. Joni Mitchell, Both Sides Now?
Yeah, this is part of my point, is that we will say, okay, Journey, that's schlock, but Bruce Springsteen, Joni Mitchell, these kind of canonical figures are thought to be somehow in a different category. Now,
yes,
maybe they are in a different category because they've written a lot of great songs and these are great artists. But you mentioned Both Sides Now. That's obviously a gorgeous song. It's a very kind of, I suppose you'd say, philosophical lyric. The one that I include on the list is Joni Mitchell's kind of re-recording of that song in the year 2000, and not as a kind of gentle folk ballad, but as a big, pretty grandiose, almost Frank Sinatra, Nelson Riddle style pop ballad with full orchestra. And that, to me, really kind of captures the essence of that song, which is, in the best sense, its schlocky heart.
Rose and flows.
What? This is beautiful. That's Jody Rosen, pop music critic for New York Magazine and Vulture.com, on the joys of schlock music. I was with him until this one. Your vote for schlock songs at hereandnow.org.
And feather canyons everywhere.
We're taking a break from headlines today, listening to pop songs that music critic Jody Rosen calls schlock, but in a good way. At the top of Jody's list, Judy Garland's ravaged rendition of Over the Rainbow at Carnegie Hall in 1961, 22 years after she first introduced the song.
Somewhere over the rainbow, way off.
Number four, country legend George Jones' 1980 weeper, He Stopped Loving Her Today.
This time, he's over her for good. He stopped loving her today. It placed a wreath upon his door. And soon they'll carry him away. He stopped loving her today.
Also in the top 10, Ray Charles' America the Beautiful.
Oh, beautiful, for heroes proved in liberating strife. Who more than self?
They're all from the list of 150 greatest schlock songs ever. Feel free to nominate yours at hereandnow.org. Jody Rosen is pop music critic for New York Magazine and Vulture.com. His piece is In Defense of Schlock Music, Why Journey, Billy Joel, and Lionel Richie Are Better Than You Think. And Jody, you write about a straight line you can draw from old schlock to new, maybe not even yet defined a schlock, a line you draw from Bette Midler's From a Distance right through Cher's Believe to Katy Perry?
Yeah, I mean, schlock kind of reflects the times. So our current moment, we're in sort of like a, you know, therapy culture moment, where a lot of the what you listen to when you hear top 40 radio, a lot of it are kind of ballads of self-esteem, sort of pep talks, a little bit Oprah Winfrey in there. I call this music Oprah opera. So Katy Perry's Roar, which I think is a great song, you know, sonically, production-wise, yeah, it's a very modern-sounding song. It's got a very emphatic beat. The production is quite up to date. The lyrics are really a chimerical mishmash of all kinds of old things, because there's references to We Are the Champions, Queen's very schlocky 1970s ballad. There's references to Eye of the Tiger, the great Rocky III theme song. There's references to Helen Reddy's I Am Woman in there, which I think is kind of feminist schlock. And so what we've got is a kind of pep talk song for anyone who sings along to feel good about themselves or better about themselves, which to me is kind of archetypally 2013, 2014 sentiment.
Well, it's even got a little of the Little Drummer Boy in it with the pum 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 pum. Let's listen, please, to Katy Perry. Jody, our engineer of the program, who's really loves music, John Parati, wondered where this fell on your list. Let's listen.
Hello. Is it me you're looking for?
Now, I love that song, and yet in the context of this conversation, that is so overblown, even in the first word.
As for where that song falls on my list, it's somewhere in the 30s. There are five songs written by Lionel Richie on this list. And in fact, one of the things that motivated me to write this in the first place is my absolute adoration, my love of Lionel Richie, who I think is an overlooked figure. You know, he's the biggest hitmaker of the 1980s, besides people like Prince and Madonna and Bruce Springsteen, all of whom are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And yet Lionel Richie is not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Oversight.
This is a gross injustice. Mm-hmm. But he is a great songwriter. And he points out something I think very important about schlock, which is that schlock is music that embraces kind of voluptuousness and beauty, pure melodic beauty. If our aesthetics are such that, you know, this pure beauty is somehow viewed as bad taste or déclassé, I think there's some kind of messed up priorities there.
Well, there's no other way we cannot listen to what you call one of the great schlock masterpieces of all time, Lionel Richie's Endless Love with Diana Ross. It builds to the rapture. It is, it's biblical.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. Or, yeah, it's biblical in the sense of a man and a woman having biblical knowledge of one another. Let's put it that way. It's sensual rapture, right? But also it's just that the melody just comes at you in wave after wave, crescendo after crescendo. It doesn't really even sound like a normal pop song. It's just kind of like this flow of beauty. That said, it's really corny. But who cares?
Someone here just said it's the bolero of pop.
If we had just schlock and it was not leavened by anything else, it would be oppressive. And maybe that's why at various moments in musical history there's been such disdain for it. We're at this moment right now where we've seen a kind of new formation of kind of a new great American songbook, if you will. And one of its notable features is that so many of these power ballads of the last few decades are in there. You know, if you see what they sing on The Voice or American Idol or on Glee, or most importantly, karaoke. What are the karaoke go-to songs? It's all these schlock ballads. It's Billy Joel. It's Lionel Richie. It's Def Leppard. It's you name it, right? And so, in a way, part of my point in this piece is that, hey, schlock really is the people's choice. And this is utilitarian music, okay? We turn back to schlock when there's a wedding or there's a funeral or there's a holiday or a great national calamity. I mean, think of September 11th when all of a sudden all the senators gathered on the steps of the Capitol saying, God bless America, Irving Berlin's very, very schlocky alternative national anthem. So in a way, it's grassroots music. It's the music of the mob as opposed to maybe the music that people like me who make their living, quote unquote, criticizing pop music have generally embraced.
Well, there's so much to choose from. What should we go out on? I mean, Beyonce or Whitney Houston or Aerosmith?
Aerosmith.
I don't want to miss the thing. I mean, what would you like to go out on?
How about Prince, Purple Rain? Can we do that?
We so can. What is that Purple Rain?
Nobody knows. I don't think Prince even knows.
But we love it.
We love it anyway.
Jody Rosen, a pop music critic for New York Magazine and Vulture.com. His article, In Defense of Schlock Music, Why Journey, Billy Joel, and Lionel Richie Are Better Than You Think, appears online, and we'll link you to it. Jody, what a pleasure. Great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Everybody, look, I'm still reeling from Joni Mitchell being on this list, but Jared Dewing writes us, who doesn't belt out Meatloaf's I Would Do Anything when it comes on the radio? James Gardner nominates The Sweets, Love is Like Oxygen, your nominees at hearnow.org. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. It's Here and Now.